Ah, excellent. There it is. So we're first going to hear from Hyun Lee, who is a member of Nodutol for Korean Community Development, as well as the National Campaign to End the Korean War. She's part of the Working Group for Peace and Demilitarization in Asia and the Pacific, and she co-produces the Asia-Pacific Forum, which is a weekly radio show on culture and politics in Asia and the Asian diaspora. So, Hyun Lee, take it away.
Thanks, Sarah. So I would like to give a short presentation in two parts. I'd like to spend about 5 minutes talking about U.S. strategy of regime collapse vis-a-vis North Korea. And then the next 5 minutes, I would like to just talk about North Korea's strategic response to that. And then after that, I think Juyeon will speak just 5 minutes on her experience traveling to the DPRK for the past 10 years. And then we'd like to leave a lot of time for questions and answers. So I'd like to begin by reading a quote by a man named Jeffrey Bader. He is known as the architect of the Obama administration's policy on North Korea, and he was the senior director for East Asian Affairs at the White House National Security Council in Obama's first term, and he wrote a book called Obama and China's Rise. And in this book, he writes about U.S. Policy or U.S. intentions vis-a-vis North Korea, and he writes, "Many of us believed that the most likely long-term solution to North Korea's nuclear pursuits lay in the North's collapse and absorption into a South-led reunified Korea. At the same time, he says, a strategy was still needed to slow down, freeze, and degrade the North Korean program until history could take its course." I like to point out this quote because in two concise sentences, basically what Bader does is summarize the past 20 years of U.S. policy towards North Korea, which is to say, delay North Korea's nuclear program until the eventual collapse of the regime. North Korea's goal for the past 20 years, on the other hand, has been the fundamental change in U.S. policy towards North Korea. In other words, it would no longer be considered an enemy state. And North Korea has been very consistent in its demands to the United States. Number one, security assurance that the U.S. Has no intention to attack it. And number two, normalization of relations, meaning ending the state of war that's been in place for the past 60 years, lifting sanctions, et cetera, so that North Korea can go about developing its own economy. Since the early 1990s until now, talks between the United States and North Korea took many forms, sometimes bilateral, other times multilateral, and they produced a series of agreements, starting with the agreed framework in 1994, the joint communique in 2000, and then a series of six-party talk declarations. And each time, the basic substance of the agreements were essentially the same. North Korea agreed to halt its nuclear program in exchange for security assurance and a pledge to normalize relations with the United States. The United States routinely violated these agreements because everyone believed the North Korean regime would eventually collapse. So the U.S. was never really serious about following up on these agreements, and it never moved towards normalization. In the meantime, the United States developed regime collapse theories and waged a multi-pronged attack to isolate and strangle the country. So number one, it developed Operation Plan 5029, which is an unconventional war plan for occupation in the event of regime collapse in North Korea. Number two, it conducts massive war games multiple times a year that threaten its security. Number three, it has imposed ever harsher sanctions to basically choke its economy. And number four, It has been funded through the NED, the National Endowment for Democracy. It has been funding citizens groups to agitate for North Korea's collapse under the guise of human rights advocacy, all the while trying to delay North Korea's nuclear program through the six-party talks during the Bush administration. Now, Obama took office in 2008. This was right after the former North Korean leader Kim Jong-il suffered a stroke. And South Korean and U.S. experts once again predicted North Korea's collapse after the former leader's death, which they believed was imminent. And so then Obama adopted the policy of strategic patience, which basically means waiting and preparing for North Korea's eventual collapse. However, North Korea defied everyone's predictions. Kim Jong-il did die in 2011, but the regime did not collapse. And in fact, the transition to the new leadership has been pretty smooth. So since Kim Jong-il's death, which was end of 2011 until now, so for the past year and a half, the United States has been quietly escalating war threats on the Korean Peninsula. So some examples of what it has been doing, in all of this took place in 2012, last year. It conducted massive war games multiple times, involving hundreds of thousands of South Korean troops, tens of thousands of U.S. troops. And now these exercises are openly exercising regime collapse scenarios and step-by-step plan. In the event the regime collapses, then how the South Korean and U.S. militaries would invade, occupy, and implement counterinsurgency programs. And the scenarios of these exercises also include practice bomb runs to imitate nuclear strikes against North Korea. The United States has also transferred mine-resistant armored vehicles that were used in Iraq and Afghanistan to the DMZ. The United States also allowed South Korea to extend its missile range from 300 to 800 kilometers, meaning South Korea now has the capability to strike anywhere in North Korean territory. These are just some examples. The list goes on and on. But in the interest of time, I'm going to move on. I hope Gregory Ilitch, who's also on the call later on, will be able to talk about tailored deterrence and kill chain, basically plan for preemptive strike against North Korean missiles. So basically, North Korea sees its security as threatened, and also its economy is being choked. Now, it has a new leadership, and defending sovereignty and economic development, these two are the highest national priorities of North Korea. And so North Korea basically sees no choice but to resist and fight against U.S. plans. So now this brings me to the second part of my presentation, which is about how North Korea has been strategically responding. So in July 2012, North Korea's foreign ministry issued a memo that signaled a fundamental shift in its policy towards the United States. The memo said that North Korea had reviewed the past 20 years of negotiations with the United States and has come to the conclusion that they have failed. And unless the United States acts first to demonstrate that it is sincere in fundamentally changing its policy toward it, North Korea is no longer interested in any talks, and it will prepare for war. And then a few weeks after this memo, North Korea's new leader, Kim Jong-un, made a banquet speech. And in this speech, he said, "Our patience has limits," and he called for nationwide preparation for what they're calling the Great War for National Unification. So now, declaring a war on the greatest military power in the world seems preposterous and ludicrous to us. But what North Korea is actually doing is putting the U.S. in a position where it has limited options. So at this point, it seems the United States has three options. The first one is obvious: risk frontal war with North Korea. But this is not what the U.S. wants. The U.S. has been preparing for unconventional war, regime collapse and occupation. The United States does not want a frontal war with North Korea. Not only would that be catastrophic for the people of the Korean Peninsula, but it's also not within U.S. geostrategic interests, because North Korea says it is ready to launch surgical strikes against U.S. bases in South Korea, Japan, possibly in Guam. And, you know, the U.S. has those bases there for broader interests in the region, and it does not want to risk its force posture there. The other option the U.S. has is to continue to ignore North Korea's threats. But what this means is that North Korea will continue to test nuclear weapons and launch satellites. And it has many satellite launches planned for this year. North Korea's nuclear tests have already fueled conservatives in South Korea and Japan, which have their own nuclear ambitions. Since North Korea's nuclear test back in February, there have been growing calls in South Korea's conservative party for South Korea to develop its own nuclear deterrence capability. And something that the Western media doesn't talk about at all is that the South Korea-U.S. Atomic Energy Agreement is up for renewal this year. This agreement was signed in 1974. Under this agreement, the United States provides nuclear technologies and materials to South Korea. In return, South Korea is specifically prohibited from proliferation-related activities, such as reprocessing spent fuel and uranium enrichment. This agreement is up for renewal next year in March, and it is currently under negotiation. And that's one of the reasons why Kerry is in Asia, and then Park, the new president of South Korea, is coming to the United States next month. And her top priority agenda is to renegotiate this deal so that South Korea can develop its own nuclear weapons. Now, nuclear nonproliferation is a top priority for the Obama administration. And to prevent proliferation in Northeast Asia, it is imperative for the United States to resolve its conflict with North Korea. So then this leaves the United States with a third option, which is then abandon regime collapse scenarios and start peace talks, and finally end the Korean War and normalize relations with North Korea, which is what North Korea has been demanding all along. And this seems to me the only path towards nonproliferation and also avoiding catastrophic damage. However, we are seem to be running out of time, because the risk of a war breaking out on the Korean Peninsula based on miscalculation is increasing day by day. We can get into that more, and I'm sure Gregory can talk a lot about that later on during the Q&A. I will just end by saying that the task for U.S. progressives at this point, I think, is to really counter the media propaganda and misinformation about what's happening right now. And I think we need to be calling for an end to the very provocative war games, an end to sanctions, and a call for peace talks to finally end the Korean War. And I'll stop there, and I'll hand it over to Jian.
I hope everyone can hear me okay.
Yeah. Just before Janri begins to say that she is also leading in Nodutol and has twice organized Korean delegations to the North and has many exchanges and experiences there.
Thank you, Sarah. Hi. So I have been, Roosevelt has this program visiting North and South Korea alternatively each year, and we have been doing that to South Korea since 1995 and to North Korea since 2001. after June 15 summit of North and South Korean presidents. I just wanted to bring a little bit of an ideas about the two major misconceptions that people have about North Korea. Whenever we talk about the North Korea issue, many, many people we have heard over the years is that, you know, one, people are, people do not, it appears to me as if that, you know, people do not think that North Korean people have self-agency. You know, a lot of people think that North Korean people are just suffering under the dictatorship. Or, you know, it's all about the state, all about the regime, all about the leadership, but never about the people. There are 24 million people living, and that's what we have been trying to get is people-to-people exchange, and just to get a glimpse of how North Koreans are living there, what kind of system, what do they think about, and all those things. I would like to say a start with it. One of those visits in 2011, we had a chance to sit down with the students. The night before, we had met with the farmers who were very young farmers who were in their early 20s. They were all living in this cooperative farm, and they have been, you know, volunteered or they were assigned to this farm, like, you know, less than 2 years or so. And they were forming a very small, like, a tight collective. And, you know, so it was about seven of us who went there. So after, like, a little bit of awkward first introduction, somebody from our delegation asked them, you know, is there any question that you want to ask us instead of us always asking you a question? And one of the girls said, what do people in the U.S. think of us? And people were just looking at each other. We didn't know what to say. And we said, well, they don't know much about people in North Korea. And she had a little bit of a sad face. And she said, they don't like us today. We have read and heard that people in the world do not really appreciate, you know, our country. And what do you say to that, you know? So people are aware. I mean, you know, there are a lot of, I mean, they have lived in these international sanctions, all these war games. So they have go on to an alert, right? Whenever there is a bald eagle or key reserve war games, the entire country goes on an alert and they become this emergency state. So they know that these military exercises to bring their country down is going on. They really feel the war in day-to-day basis. The fact that the Korean War has never ended, it's their living current political reality. So, you know, the following day we sat with a student, and one of the icebreaker questions that our delegation member decided to ask was, you know, always safe to go with dating issue, right? Do you date? Where do you go? And these were. So she says, she started by saying, oh, well, do you date in this country? Or do you date generally, I guess. But then another student took it very personally, and he said, of course we date. Do you think we are all like military people who do not date? And there was a long silence. We just didn't know how to overcome that. I mean, of course, you know, you would date. We were just trying to, you know, and then I tried to do the damage control, and the guy said, you know, I guess, obviously went to Singapore to study. And in the 6 months of the period that he was staying there, I'm not sure how long he stayed, but, you know, I guess he get this impression that a lot of people don't think, they do not really perceive North Koreans as a human beings. You know, I guess he got a lot of questions, like, you know, people are like robots, whatever, brainwashed people. So then he was personally really offended, and he was responding in such a way. So, you know, given those exchanges and things, that I a lot of times wonder, you know, what Koreans are really a fierce resistance people with a struggles against the, you know, social change, for the betterment in as a people living in this North Korea at this current period. What are they going through? You know, the sanctions have been imposed, and then the toughest sanction, I guess, UN just imposed in January of this year, is only hurting people. I mean, there is no syringe in the hospitals that they, unless they can recreate it, invent it, and they can make it themselves, they are virtually blocked from bringing most of the modern goods. And then, you know, the newspaper always say this is one of the most isolated countries. And people do not even have an internet. They don't know. And they are just suffering, I guess, you know. So these are, I think, these misconceptions. People do try to make their life better. There has been a lot of organic agriculture experiments because they couldn't make fertilizers anymore because of the lack of oil import. You know, a lot of factories stopped making fertilizers. Less fertilizer means less production in the agricultural goods. And they are going to suffer through the lack of, you know, food. I mean, you know, North Korea is a very known to be a mountainous area. They have only less than 20% of arable land. You know, however, they have been trying really their best to make it better. Consumer goods are getting more and more. They are trying to make much more, you know, colorful. I mean, more colorful clothing. And also, because the children had suffered under the famine in from 2004 to 2008, has much shorter than the average children in North Korea standard. So then, you know, they are shorter than the following generation of students. So for them, the North Korean factories has been trying to make a high heel platform shoes. So you see a lot of high school nowadays, mid and high school students wearing those platform shoes and, you know, walking around when you go to North Korea. North Korea is not as isolated as a lot of people think. And there are a lot of, you know, renovations of apartments, rebuilding, construction is happening. If there is no machine and oil, people will do it by hand. You know, even if they have to pick up their shovel and sickles and whatever, they are not going to sit idle and wait. There was this song, we are going this year as well in August as a 2013 delegation for peace. We were trying to sing some, learn some North Korean songs. So I was downloading some North Korean songs in the internet. And one of the most popular songs last year and this year is that, you know, we carry on. We do what we say we do. So, and even the song, the lyric goes, you know, we'll do what we said we do. And we will not do when we say we are not going to do. And I was thinking, what would be the situation where people are, this becomes a popular song, you know? So I hope that, you know, people, when there is a lot of dialogue happening about the peace and about the state-to-state, the warfare, I really do hope that, you know, people will consider about the self-agency and about the juche, equally as a juche, self-determination and the national sovereignty of the how the people perceive in the North Korea. I'm going to just wrap it up there. Is that okay?
Thank you, Chan.
Okay.
Should we, before we go into the question and answer, let me ask, for folks who've come on the call since we began, if you want to identify yourself. And Joe, I don't know if you can turn off and on the recording part or not? All right, so hand it over to the presenters, and also Greg, do you want to come in now, or do you want to wait until there's a few questions?
I'll wait until appropriate moment of the conversation.
Okay. All right. So can a few people ID yourself if you'd like to ask a question?
Don from Chicago.
Abayomi from Detroit.
Stan Smith from Chicago.
Okay. Now, who was the first person from Chicago?
Don.
Don, okay. So let's take Don, Abayomi, and Stan. How's that?
One of the questions was listed on the invitation was some discussion of how China fits into the picture, and that didn't yet get addressed, and I would be very interested in knowing what the speakers think about the role that China is playing and may play.
These things were often fantastic.
Okay. Thank you. Next, Abayomi.
Okay, I had one question and two brief comments. The question is, I read on the Korean Central News Agency website that the U.S. Had deployed two nuclear-powered ships in the area around the Korean Peninsula, and also a nuclear submarine. I wanted to get some comments on that. Also, just briefly, in regard to the comments about the isolation of the DPRK, it's not uniform. Depends on which countries are involved. I know that there are several African states that have good relations with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Benin is one. Senegal, I know they've done work there. And also Zimbabwe, they assisted in the consolidation of the national independence, like 3 decades ago in Zimbabwe. And also just recently they sent a greetings to the president and the country on the 33rd anniversary of Zimbabwe independence. So I know that they do have relations with numerous African states. And finally, I just wanted to announce that this coming Saturday in Detroit, some young people are organizing a demonstration downtown at the Hart Plaza against U.S. War policy against North Korea, and also in defense of the DPRK. That's going to be taking place this Saturday at 3:30, and we'll try to take some photographs so we can post them on the website. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Abayomi. Okay, I think Stan is next.
Yeah, when I was reading about North Korea, I also read something that in the Asian Times, I think in 2009, that South Korea admitted in 2004 that they had been enriching uranium and plutonium in order to develop a bomb. I haven't heard anything more about what South Korea is doing on that. I was wondering if speakers could address that.
Okay. All right, so let's pass it back to the presenters, and then we'll take another round.
I can start us off and then turn it over to Gregory and Jian. On the question.
By the way, just a minute, just before you start. So we're recording, right? Hello? Okay, I'll assume we're recording. Go on. Good.
In terms of China, North Korea and China have had a military alliance for the past, going back 60 years, and also have an economic partnership in an area of North Korea called Dajin Sambong. But also, obviously, China has an economic interdependent relationship with the United States.
Dale in Chicago.
And I think Gregory can talk much better about how the United States has been intensifying pressure on China to play more of a role to restrain North Korea and to support the latest round of sanctions. China knows that U.S. interest in the broader Asia-Pacific region is ultimately a conflict with its own interests. And it has been a consistent voice for advocating for negotiations, for talks between North Korea and the United States. But I think ultimately China will be very pragmatic in this situation to see, you know, where it has the siding with which party it has more to lose. I think will in the end is how China will decide to play a role in this situation. But I think on that question, I'll turn it over to Gregory. In terms of the deployment of nuclear-powered submarines, that's always been a part of U.S. Military exercises, joint exercises with South Korea. You know, I think we've also heard recently in the news that the U.S. Deployed nuclear-capable B-52 strategic bombers and also B-2 stealth bombers close to North Korea's borders in as part of these key resolve full legal exercises that have been ongoing this month. And I think what the United States is doing is trying to demonstrate to North Korea, you know, the message that they're sending to North Korea is that we can crush you from the sea, from the air, from land. I think that's what that demonstration is all about. And then in terms of South Korea's nuclear ambitions, I hadn't heard about the 2004 uranium enrichment activities, but you know, South Korea is a leading country. Has a leading industry in nuclear nuclear program, and South Korea has many nuclear power plants, and basically President Park's top priority is to be able to develop its own nuclear nuclear weapons, and that is currently under negotiation with the United States.
Yes, just to add on a few comments about China. One of the ways the United States got China to agree to sanctions against North Korea is that they basically gave the Chinese an ultimatum that either you agree to these sanctions or we're going to substantially increase our military presence in the region. And the Chinese understood that this military presence would be not only targeted at North Korea, but at China as well. So China went along with those sanctions, and the United States is again using that same threat against the Chinese, saying if you don't apply economic pressure on North Korea and limit your trade with them, we'll expand our military presence in the region. So this is a ultimatum that they're going to continue to trot out. The Chinese don't really have that much leeway in what they can do, I think, because they have extremely important trade relations with the United States that they're reluctant to put to strain, I think. And I think the United States is also using a very indirect way of getting the Chinese to apply a kind of economic blockade on North Korea without even being official policy. For instance, the U.S. Treasury Department just issued sanctions on North Korea's foreign trade bank. So any bank anywhere in the world that does business with North Korea's foreign trade bank, and this is the main bank North Korea uses for its international trade, any bank anywhere in the world that does business with a bank cannot do business with an American financial institution. Now, this is quite a difficult step because I think something like 95% or 85%, I forget the exact figure, of international trade is done based on the U.S. dollar. So if you can't do international trade because you can't use U.S. financial institutions, then you're not exactly going to want to do business with North Korea's foreign trade bank. So that's kind of an indirect way of applying sanctions. So Chinese banks are in the same situation. you'll have a choice of either you do business with North Korea's Foreign Trade Bank or you don't engage in any international financial transactions whatsoever. As far as South Korea's nuclear program, if I remember correctly, and it's been quite some time since I read about that, I think that was in its early stages during the administration of Park Chung-hee, dictator, and South Korea gave it up when the United States promised to provide a nuclear umbrella for South Korea.
But I think most of the things were talked about. I think I cannot really add on too much. I'm just going to talk about how South Korea, also a newspaper, has been adding and reporting about these nuclear powered carriers and the nuclear submarine. I believe the name was Saiyan or Cheyan. Was a part of this this year's nuclear the joint war exercise, joint military exercises in Key Reserve and Bow Eagle, and also I just wanted to say a little bit about the isolation. I believe the person who said about the African state is right, and also. And when you go to North Korea, you will meet a lot of people from Sweden, Switzerland, and some South Asian countries. So Philippines are also planning to send a large delegation to the, one of the international conference happening in July for the victory of the Korean War celebration that is really large. And Malaysia and Singapore, and also I guess Iran and Iraq for the reasons that we can really guess logically, they have a really good relationship. So it's not like North Korea has been really isolated, and it's all alone in the world. It's just the U.S. leading UN and. The Western Europe countries has been trying to actively isolate North Korea.
Thank you. All right, should we take another round of another stack, three or four more questions? And I think we're going to try to do this at least twice more. So. Who would like to be next? Number to unmute.
Allison?
Allison, okay. Anyone else? Okay, Allison, why don't you go and then we'll see again.
Sure. Thank you, everyone, and thanks to UNAC for organizing this call. Here in Vancouver, we've started to organize some activities in solidarity with actions in the United States against threats and sanctions and increased attacks against North Korea, and it's really helpful to get this perspective and to hear directly from people that have so much experience with North Korea and South Korea and really the history. We started with including North Korea in our demands for an anti-war rally that we had on Saturday, this past Saturday, and really understood what was addressed earlier as far as the image that people have about the people of North Korea, and something that was very apparent from people on the streets. And so I really agree that that's an important component of the educational work that all of us as anti-war and peace activists need to do. We were able to show a film made by a director who lives in New York called North Korea Beyond the DMZ. It's available from the Third World Newsreel there in New York City. And we showed it at a film festival we held, the 10th International Film Festival for Peace. And I encourage other people to look up that film if they're looking for resources about things to include at educational events. It was really a very telling film of what life in North Korea really looks like. Of course, it's one side and one person's story, but we found it very useful. So we're going to continue our educational work here and also talking a lot around the perspective of really seeing these attacks on North Korea, of course, as part of this 60-year Korean War that is yet to end, and continuing occupation, especially on the demilitarized zone, but also within these latest attacks in North Africa and the Middle East, really seeing this as the U.S. furthering their expansion of what we refer to as the new era of war and occupation onto the Korean Peninsula, doing so with threats and sanctions and an extremely powerful demonization campaign in the media. This really has to become part of our regular work because it's all interconnected, especially when we talk about attacks on the Korean Peninsula being so close to China, which we really see as their main enemy and main target in the coming years. So something that I wanted also to ask about that we've discussed a bit here outside of discussing, I mean, the importance of demands calling for hands off North Korea and into the sanctions on North Korea, also trying to understand more about politics in South Korea. And from what we understand, it's really the latest election has really brought to power one of the most right-wing governments in South Korea. And I'm wondering what people see as the implications of this and how it might relate to the work that we do here in Vancouver with the Korean community, but also just in general with our educational campaign. So thank you all, and I'm sorry if that was a bit long.
Thank you, Allison. Before we hand back to the presenters, let me ask if there's a couple of other questions. And I will add one point that I had. I thought it was helpful, Allison raised a film, and to ask if particular material, there were several links presented in this email, but if there's material you think would be particularly helpful to highlight that. And wanted to ask a little bit more description of the scale of these U.S. war games, how often they are, the impact it has in the entire region. I recently heard a presentation on that. It was really, I think, important maybe to raise a little bit more on this call. But let me ask if there are other people, comments or questions.
Yes, Tehan Song, Korea Alliance of Progressive Movements from South Korea.
Okay. Yes. Go ahead.
Should I just speak now or should I wait?
Yeah. No, go ahead.
Okay. I just wanted to thank the the UNAC organizers and presenters for these crazy growing tensions in the Korean Peninsula. Right now we're doing a photo campaign. So like the woman from Vancouver said, there's going to be a protest there, but we're trying to also increase our visibility online. So we're doing this photo campaign in cooperation with IAC and with Nodutol and with the national campaign. And basically, if people, when there's protests or events, if they could take photographs and send them to us, it would be like a great help. Right now we have a website, and I wanted to plug in that website where you could just automatically submit, and also like but the website is peaceinkorea.tumblr.com. So people could take a look at photos that have already been posted and post. And my email is DAEHAN_song@yahoo.com. Thank you.
This is Gary Davis in South Burlington. Can I have a word here?
Yes, just a minute. That was peaceinkoreatumblr.com.
Yes.
Is that correct? Okay.
.com.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Then Gary?
Yeah, I was a bomber pilot, World War II, and I figured out that we have to eliminate war itself from 1945 on. We're talking about nuclear now. Are we talking about North and South Korea and the United States as if they are real? But war eliminates humans. And the nuclear option, as Einstein says, is going to eliminate the human race. So we can't even talk about North Korea, South Korea, the United States. We have to have laws against war itself. That is the real issue here. It's nothing to do with the United States that has 8,000 nuclear weapons or North Korea that has 3 nuclear weapons. We cannot afford nuclear. And that's been touted from ever since 1945. Nuclear war is eliminating the human race. There are 9 men in the world, heads of state, who have nuclear weapons at their fingertips. Are we insane to think that the nation state is not dysfunctional? I'm a stateless person. I gave up my nationality when I was 26 years old. I claimed to be a world citizen. And we have the world government of world citizens operating now since 1953. That's based upon the Declaration of Human Rights. Nobody mentions human rights in this conversation. And yet it says all humans are born free and equal in dignity and rights, and the will of the people should be the basis of the authority of government. Let us wake up and realize that humanity itself is in danger. And if humanity doesn't have laws, then somebody's going to push that button, and that's the end of the human race. Because nuclear is not a war. It is a genocide. And that's been touted for ever since 1945. So let's wake up and say, wait a minute. Humanity itself is in danger. Humanity is now a plaintiff. The International Criminal Court says in its own statute. What is the enemy of humanity? It's war itself. So let's wake up and say, wait a minute, we are all citizens of this world, whether we like it or not. I don't care what we believe. I don't care what our nationality is, which is a function taken over from the 18th, 19th century.
Okay. Thank you, Gary. Next, any other comments or questions? We're at 10 o'clock.
I had a question.
Incredible hour.
Diane,
okay.
In Chicago again. Are any of the speakers going to be touring?
Before? Okay.
You hear me?
I'm sorry. Dan, finish?
Yes, I said, are any of the speakers going to be touring so like we could organize an event here in Chicago with one of them come and speak?
Okay. Question. Okay.
I have a question. This is Claudia in San Francisco. I'd like to know how to stay in touch, and I would also like to very much support the comment of the first to last person. I think his name is Gary, because sometimes it does feel that these conversations are unreal, as if we were speaking about something that you can play a video game, and the consequences of these decisions are enormous and very disturbing, to say the least. So I appreciate that comment. But I'd like to know how to stay in touch as well.
And we will have that also on our website, along with a tape of this whole conversation, educational, the answers to the questions. But
I received the invitation via another person, so I don't know the website either. And I didn't send
that
in an email. Yeah.
Great. That will be on UNAC, UNAC, Peace.
UNAU,
as in United,
yes.
N as in national, A as in anti-war, C as in coalition. Peace. PEACE. UNACPeace.org. And that is where both the questions, a link to this conversation, and resources, and so on will be.
Okay.
So I'm going to pass it back to the presenters.
This is Joe, if I can get on stack too, Sarah.
Okay, maybe Joe, you go before we pass it back to the presenters.
Okay. I just wanted to say, first of all, on the China question, I agree with what Allison said, that I think that one of the ultimate targets of the U.S. militarization and the recent increase in militarization in the whole Pacific region is China, and that everything we're doing in terms of sanctions and threats towards North Korea needs to be seen a little bit in that context, because North Korea is right on the border with China. I think that's important. But the other thing I wanted to say is just we as the anti-war movement in the United States, and I guess with Allison in Canada and perhaps someone from South Korea, we need to start talking about the situation with North Korea. There's several hotspots right now that could lead towards war. And people might know that this month in the United States is an anti-drone month. We're doing a lot of protests against drones. And UNAC has put out, and I believe it's on the website already, but I'm not sure. If not, it will be soon, a statement that can be passed out at some of the actions that are taking place, which does connect the issues of the drones and the hotspots where there are threats of war, where U.S. is threatening. People might have heard that in the last couple of days there's been talk in the U.S. of perhaps doing direct military intervention in Syria, which is another area. So while we are protesting the drones this month, I hope people will take that statement of UNAC's and start talking about the threats that North Korea, Syria, and Iran, you know, in the whole context of our protests this month. That's all I want to say.
Thank you, Joe. And this is important. There's an action in New York, for example, this Saturday at Union Square, on definitely on the use of drones, weapons that strike every single day, every day, in different countries. But Korea and Stop the Threat from Korea is very much a strong part of Saturday's demonstration, as it should be in everything that we're doing. So let me hand this back to our presenters. And thank you, Yun and Jae-yoon and Greg, Gary and Greg.
This is Yun. Just two quick comments, and then I'd like to hand it over to Chuyan and Gregory. So in terms of a possible resource for folks who want to maybe organize locally, educational events around this issue. One possible resource is a new film called Memories of Forgotten War. This is a documentary based on interviews with oral histories of survivors of the Korean War who are living in the United States. It is right now making the film festival circuit. But I know that the producers of the film are very much interested in partnering with local peace groups who want to do their own screenings. And if they cannot fly out there themselves to speak, they can at least, I think they're putting together like a curriculum that will go with the film for group discussion, et cetera. So that's one resource I'd like to put out there. I think you can search online, Memories of Forgotten War. And you can find the website and the contact information for the producers. Just one comment about kind of U.S. broader interest in the region vis-a-vis China, and you know why the United States is doing this in terms of North Korea. I agree with the folks who spoke earlier about kind of U.S. Is looking across the Pacific Ocean and sees Asia as this vast continent that is full of promise, right? Especially in this very crippling global economic recession. Asia is huge. It's rich in resources and cheap labor, huge giant market for the United States. And obviously the United States wants to make sure that it is, and not China, leading the process of economic integration in the region. In 2011, Obama announced a shift in military resources to Asia. People are referring it to it as the pivot to Asia. And the U.S. is increasing its naval presence in the region because it wants to make sure it's controlling the sea lanes and trade routes. It's also increasing its diplomatic presence in multilateral institutions like APEC. Basically, U.S. interest in this region is number one, make sure that it is leading the process of economic integration there through things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which is this huge multinational trade agreement that is the largest in history. It's basically making sure that economic integration happens according to U.S. Rules and regulations. Also, the United States wants to make sure that the region is quote-unquote free, secure for easy flow of capital in and out of the region. And it's in that context when the United States looks across at the region, it sees North Korea as a quagmire because it is threatening, quote-unquote, peace and security for free flow of capital in the region. And the way that the United States has chosen to deal with such quagmires in the Middle East, for example, in recent past, is through regime collapse and occupation. And North Korea, when it looks at this history, has very little reason to believe that it will not meet the same fate. So it's in that context that we should also look at the current crisis on the Korean Peninsula. But on the question of South Korean politics, I don't want to put Tae-han on the spot, but since he is on the ground in South Korea, I wonder if he can speak a little bit to that. And then also I wonder if Gregory can talk a little bit about Taylor deterrence and kill chain.
Okay, Fionn. Go ahead.
Oh, me? Oh, I thought do we want to hear from Tae-han about, you know, what's really happening in South Korea right now against these two, okay, or do you want me just to go and comment? Sorry about that.
Okay.
Okay, so I just want to, I think I agree with what you said. I wanted to just add a couple of things. I just lost my train of thought. Sorry about that. Oh, okay. So in the regionally, I think there are a lot of activities are happening. So in LA in May, on August 8th and 9th, there will be a conference to end the Korean War conference with the UCLA. So if you are in the California region, maybe you can look out for that. There will be in Chicago, I believe we can, I don't think we are going to tour too much, but you know, there are certain groups that is very aware of the situation. I think there are some regional, Korean Americans are also mobilizing ourselves to form a lot of activities. I'm positively sure if there are something, then you know, we will try to contact the UNAC, because UNAC has been really a great ally for Noduto in this issue. We'll try to advertise it and then proceed with that. I think I had only that comment.
Will you just give the date again and place on the conference?
Sure. The conference in LA, UCLA, is May 8th and 9th. And then there is the United Methodist church women's division is meeting, having a community gathering on Korean War issue on Friday at in Koreatown United Methodist Church. I think it's a Wilshire Church.
Great, thank you. Okay.
Could you please repeat the name of the documentary? Could you please repeat the name of the documentary?
It was A Memory of a Forgotten War.
The Memory of the Forgotten War.
Yes.
Okay. So I'm Googling and I'm finding something else called The Forgotten War, but
it's from more films.
Memory of. Okay, thank you.
Okay. I have almost quarter after 10. Any closing? And Greg, do you want to speak?
Sure.
Again?
Sure. And answer to the gentleman who wanted a speaker in Chicago, I think I could suggest that he contacts the Korea Policy Institute. I believe there's at least one member of the Korea Policy Institute who lives in the Chicago area, so I think there's a possibility of getting a speaker there. So it's kpolicy.org is the website. And I'd like to talk a little bit about tailored deterrence, and actually this ties in, Sarah, with your question about the war games a little bit, because this is the first time that these war games tested out the tailored deterrence policy. There's an annual security consultative meeting between the U.S. military and South Korea military. The last meeting took place in October, and there the military has developed a new plan they called tailored deterrence, which the South Korean military guards as the most important decision that came out of that meeting. Tailored deterrence calls for specific military responses to a variety of scenarios, from minor to major. And the plans call for joint U.S. and South Korean military operations against North Korean, quote, provocations or incidents. This would be the first time that the United States military would be involved in any clashes between South and North Korea, which is a dangerous escalation in itself. According to the South Korean Ministry of National Defense official, this strategy is going to be applied in both wartime and peacetime. One of the main components of tailored deterrence is what they call a kill chain, and this is an integrated system for tracking and striking North Korean missile sites. According to United States officials, they'll be able to strike North Korean missiles within 30 minutes of detection. This is basically a call for a preemptive strike. If the United States or South Korea sees a North Korean missile site that they perceive as being in a position to, with the intent of firing a missile at South Korea, they launch a strike. The North Korean missile, according to one U.S. commander, does not even have to be in position to fire it. They just have to have the U.S. or South Korea just has the perception that they might do that. The kill chain calls for detection of missile sites by U.S. satellites and drones, and the strikes would be by South Korean missiles and warplanes. This is also part of the tailored deterrence, is what's called a counter-provocation plan, which would call for U.S. and South Korean forces to hit not only the source of the immediate conflict, but also command sites. So commanding forces would be hit. And this would involve U.S. missiles and warplanes hitting it. According to one South Korean military official, commanders would be given authority to strike back at North Korea with 10 times as much force as North Koreans would employ. So you can imagine how this scenario would play out. There might be some minor incident. Or even take, say, example like the sinking of the Chonan, where North Korea was blamed for the sinking of that ship, but the preponderance of evidence shows it is more likely due to accidental hitting of a South Korean mine. South Korea and U.S. forces would strike North Korean targets with 10 times as much force. What would North Korea do in response to that? It's hard to imagine they would just sit there and take it. They'd likely strike back in some measure of their own. In response to that, South Korea and the U.S. forces would hit back with 10 times as much force again. And it's very easy to imagine a whole chain reaction of escalating military attacks, which in the worst-case scenario, it could lead to a total war. This is a very dangerous situation where it would just take a minor incident that could put things out of control. And during the war games, they tested this tailored deterrence for the first time. They also tested out in these war games another new policy. The United States military has formed a special unit that's responsible for if this, like, collapse or any kind of crisis in North Korea, that these U.S. forces would go into North Korea, seize nuclear weapon sites, and arrest North Korean officials. So they tested that out, too, in these latest war games. So the military alliance between South Korea and the United States have taken a whole different path compared to the past, and it's a more dangerous direction, I believe.
Thank you. I think we should close on this. I think this has been an enormously, enormously helpful, educational. I want to thank the presenters, the time, the thought that went into this, and doing it in such a tight, well-organized way. I feel like I got an enormous amount out of it. I think others do too. But let's use it as activists to bring the question of Korea very consciously into everything that we're doing, regardless of what other issue we're working on, to demand an end to U.S. threats and U.S. occupation.
Mm-hmm.
So and also staying in touch with each other. Every one of these actions, as they say, it's heartening to hear about it in South Korea, send pictures, hold up banners and signs. It's very important in this day and age that the movement connect with each other. With an action in Times Square a couple of weeks ago. There's other events coming up. So let's connect on every one of these and continue to stay in touch. But all of this will be on unacpeace.org. That's, again, UNACPEACE.org. So thank you very much.
Good night.
Good night. Thank you. Made it just here, Greg.
Yeah. That's all right. And then basically Marilyn wrapping up.